Darkwraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for autumn semester 2015. Lecture 10, delivered on September 28, 2015. The title of this lecture is Bonds.
Today, bonds. I have been talking a lot. You might have noticed that I've been talking a lot more in class about debt, and in the book too, about debt than equity. In other words, about bonds and notes and bills. I've talked more about that than I have about stock. Well, there's a couple of reasons for that, but the biggest reason is that the relative size of the bond markets compared to the equity markets, in other words, debt instruments that are bought and sold versus equity instruments like stock that is bought and sold, the bond markets are about 10 times the size of the equity markets, 10 times as large as the stock markets. Now, why would everyone talk about stocks? Why is that always on the news, the Dow Jones Industrial Average or the Standard & Poor's? Or you should buy this stock or that stock. You don't hear about the bond market. And yet it is 10 times the size of the equity market. The reason that is the case is that the bond market isn't a sexy market. Bonds tend to be less volatile. They're quieter. It's a calmer market. I mean, imagine I get to read a novel about some seafaring vessel that faces storms and monsters and whales and things that come up out of the deep and go, shit. Or I could write a novel, yeah, we had a very calm sea, nothing happened, the wind was nice, the sun was shining, the whole journey. Which novel? Oh, well, obviously they're going to cost the same, but you're going to want to read about the adventure, the action, the excitement, indeed the thrill. But the bond market is so huge, but it's a quieter market. It is less volatile. The biggest thing that happens in a bond market is when a company defaults on a bond or something like that. There is a lot of interesting stuff that goes on under the surface. And it is crucial to know bonds if you are interested in financial planning or even for your own benefit, how you balance bonds against stocks in your own equity portfolio. But the reason, let me try this. Madam, what would be your judgment? Why would the bond market be a quieter market, a less volatile market, for lack of a better term, a less sexy market than the equity market? Any idea? Let's try this. Ma'am, who has the prior claim on the cash flows of a corporation? The bondholders or the stockholders? And if once we get this down, you should write this down because I promise you there will be a question on the exam that will address exactly this point, okay? As you write down. Any idea? Who has the prior claim on the cash flows of the corporation? The bondholders or the stockholders? Bingo. You have to pay your bills before there's anything left for the equity holders. You have to pay your bills in a timely manner. That doesn't mean you pay off all your bills, but you have to make your payments, your interest payments, or you pay your accounts payable, you pay your wages. The debt holders get theirs first, always. If there's anything left, then the equity holders have the claim. They can get it as dividends and or as reinvestment in the company, but that's all. So in other words, if you want more of an assurance of your cash flow, you would invest in the bond market because there's a greater, always, just by definition, a greater probability of a payoff for you. That's why you have less volatility, is because it's a more certain kind of thing. You decided that you would major in accounting. Yes, you did. It was a bad decision, but you went with it anyway because you were going to make a lot of money. Now, you go to work every day. You work for about 10 hours. You do calculations and calculator, and you balance, and then you go home every night, and you're very tired, and you flop down in your easy chair, and you fall asleep. You might make a few phone calls and all that kind of stuff, but your life is just the same every day. Debits and credits and debits, trial balance, cash budget, capital budget, that kind of stuff. Same every day. The same coupon payment every 6 months. The same maturity, you pay off, sinking fund, very regular life. Okay, now, here's your other life. You are actually a secret agent. Your name is Bond, James Bond. Okay, but that's just a trick. You're no Bond, you're a stock.
Oh, come on.
Seriously, I mean, you are going to go out there. You are going to fight in the world where residual cash flow is everything. IPOs are happening all the time. And you don't know whether there's going to be a stock split or not. And if the Fed raises interest rates, that's going to collapse the price of the stock. You don't know what's going to happen from 1 minute to the next. You carry your gun. You carry your calculator. You're good for it. Okay? One day, you're negotiating a deal for a $5 billion IPO for Facebook. The next day, you're climbing one of the Dubai Tower that's almost a mile high, swinging from a tightrope, trying to break in and find out what the latest is on the stock prospects for Megacorp International.
Deal.
Volatility. The accountant is a bond. But you are just a bond in name only. I don't know where the hell this is going. I'm fighting real hard to get this finished up so I can move on. So shut up. Anyway, but you see, the point, though, is that bonds, they regular payments. You got your coupon, 8% on $100 million. Well, we write that check, $4 million every 6 months. Well, we got to pay it off. Well, we got to put money in the sinking fund. It's all very smooth. It's like a clock. It just keeps going around and around and around. But with stock, I mean, you don't know whether there's going to be money for a dividend the next quarter. You don't know whether there's going to be enough plowback to reinvest and to do the capital projects you want. You got your shareholders who are bitching at you because they have no covenants. Those bondholders have got you in a lock grip. Remember I told you last time about those covenants? They've got a trustee watching your company to make sure it doesn't do anything they don't want. The stockholders, they're just at the mercy of whatever is going to happen. They can go to the shareholder meeting and bitch their heads off, but if there's some hedge funds that hold the majority of the stock, they can't do anything but just hope for the ride to be a good one at the end of it. The idea there is that the bond markets are smooth, controlled markets. That's why they are so, they're larger simply because they're like that base, that substrate. Imagine someday, madam, you have a chocolate mousse, smooth, dark chocolate, then white chocolate, and then a milk chocolate. That's the base. Then you want to be radical. Raspberries on top. Now, are you going to put a pile of raspberries? No, you're going to put a nice thin layer of raspberries for that kick. Again, I'm reaching here. Help me out, okay? But the point there is that most of what we do is a base. In our lives and in our investments, we have this base that is a very smooth, controlled thing, the bond markets. And then it's only after that we go for the kick, those side streams and the side bets in the equity markets. And so that's why I spend more time than might seem normal or right on the bond markets, is simply this. They are the thing. And in your investment portfolios, one thing that we do notice when we go, we'll talk to some younger couple, well, yeah, we're doing our own investments. And we'll look at their portfolios, and their portfolios are just leaning massively into equities. And sometimes you don't even see a bond. And we have to say, look, maybe at your age, yeah, a lot of risk, a lot of volatility, expected return is high, but you've got to start building that substrate of those bonds because they will move on you. They have a great deal of investment potential, but more than that, what they do is they control the risk for that top layer of the equity. They're like that substrate that makes sure that everything, if everything goes to hell, at least you know that the bonds are going to be there. Okay, I brought this term up once before, and I don't know if anyone remembers the term at all. Flight to quality. What is that? Do you know what it is? Okay. I think I just threw it past real fast. Anyone know what flight to quality is? Okay, when markets get rough, when there's a lot of uncertainty, you will see stock markets go down. Stock market prices go down. What that is simply economics. The people are selling. They're selling the hell out of their stocks. They're getting rid of them. And as that selling goes on, the prices of the securities tend to drop. Okay, but that's freeing up money from the investor. I sold my stock. Now I've got money in a money market account. Where that money goes in a rough market, it goes right to bonds. Because those are safe instruments. The flight to quality phenomenon is when the markets get troubled and they invest and the investors sell off stocks and use the proceeds to buy bonds. Flight to quality. Quality is bonds. The stock holders could end up with nothing, but the bond holders, they have the prior claim. So they'll get something if everything goes to hell, the zombie apocalypse and all that. So, and matter of fact, there's an old saying, I probably shouldn't even tell you this, in troubled markets, from stocks to bonds, from bonds to gold, from gold to bullets. So we always hope that everyone stops with the bonds, but sometimes they go to the gold. If you ever see the gold going down in price, then you hide because things are going to get rough. But it's just a progression that we see is that as markets get jittery, they will tend to sell off their stocks. Stocks will sell off. Prices will go down. But what that means is that money is being freed up. And the freeing up of the money, it's going to go to a higher quality, a safer instrument, bonds. So tell me what the consequence of that would be for you. What would you see happen? If you know that there's going to be a flight to quality, what would your investment strategy be in front of it? Talk to me.
I wouldn't buy the stocks.
No, you wouldn't buy the stocks, but what would you buy?
Bonds.
Why?
Be
more specific. You're a greedy son of a bitch.
You're guaranteed.
Never mind the guarantee. Because if the money is flowing out of stock, stock prices are going down. If the money is flowing into bond, what's going to happen to bond prices? Bingo. You've got an actual investment vehicle. So the bond isn't just safe. It also has that investment ride in it. Because if investors start flowing toward bonds, that's going to put pressure upward on the prices of bonds. There you are. Something nice is happening. The technicalities of a bond. The first one is one that I showed you the very first day of class, and I'll go back through it briefly here for you. If you've got a calculator, this doesn't require a financial calculator. Okay. The first kind of bond, the simplest, is actually not a bond, it's a bill. Remember I distinguished between bills, notes, and bonds. A bill is a 1 year or less instrument. Now, a treasury bill is a super safe 1 year or less instrument, and they are called a discount instrument. They are otherwise known as a zero coupon security. Zero coupon security, a zero coupon debt. In other words, you're not paid a coupon to service the debt. You just buy the instrument at a discount to par. Sometimes they're called discount securities. So in other words, I am going to get a payoff on this bond. The face value will be $1,000. That's always. Now, the book says sometimes it'll be 100. They're doing that just to kind of help it along when you're doing the 10th pricing. But the face value is $1,000. Now, you're going to pay a price that is less than $1,000 for a one-year instrument. By the way, sometimes these are called strips, although that term can be used for other things too. But it's a strip in the sense that it's stripped of any bonds. It's not, no, there's nothing sexual about it, for God's sake. It's just, it's stripped of coupon. Okay, so you're getting a strip. You're going to get this thing. The price value of it is going to be, oh, let's say you get this thing for $970. The calculation is just straight up forward. Your dollar interest, you're going to get $1,000 in a year. So you get $30. That's your payday, is the $30. Because you get your $1,000, you put in and so your yield on this little instrument is going to be nothing but $30 divided by $970. Not $1,000, you invested $970, and your dollar signs cancel, so it's a pure number. And if you work that out, really, my calculator turns off that fast? Okay, 30 divided by 970, 3.09% interest. That's your yield on it. Straight up investments. Now, these are very, if it's a T-bill, it's going to be a really safe animal. These are the things that banks can hold as in their highest tier of liquidity, because they're so safe that banks will buy these up and just hold them, saying, see, we've got this in case all hell breaks loose with all of our other investments. That they're as good as cash that way. The only difference, technically, you might have heard, remember a term from economics, close substitutes. Well, cash and T-bills are extremely close substitutes. The only difference between them, and this goes back to that lecture on Federal Reserve open market operations, the only difference is that cash can be used by a bank to make loans. A T-bill just sits there like a block. It can't be, you can't do anything with it except sell it. So anyway, that's a classic. However, that's not the only example of a strip or of a ZCB, as we call them, a zero coupon bond. I don't think the Treasury does any that are longer than a year, but there are some companies, and this was especially true back in this Wild West period in the 1990s. There was a lot of creative financing going on, to venture capital-wise, to get companies, the dot-coms, going. And one of the things that was a problem was that if a company needed money for, let's say, 7 years, it couldn't pay a coupon. Normally, you would issue a note, like a 10% coupon note for $50 million, and all that kind of stuff. But these companies were not going to have any cash flow for several years because it was all R&D, building presence on the web, that kind of stuff. This was what was going on. So these creatives out on the West Coast and a few in New York City, they were saying, okay, what we'll do is we'll design zero coupon bonds. In other words, these don't pay the investor a dime for, let's say, 10 years. And then they just pay off $1,000. And they came to be known as ZCBs, zero coupon bonds. I don't know if the book used that term, but that was what we called them back in the day, ZCBs. And there were some master players in this. Some of them, they've been made into the epitome of all that is evil. They were not quite that evil. They were trying to find ways to get companies going that didn't have cash flow for traditional debt service. So the investor essentially would do this. All right, I'm going to buy $600. I'll pay you $600 in, let's say, let's do one like 7 years. I will give you back $1,000. I won't give you anything along the way, but I'll give you back $1,000 in, let's say, 10 years. You can see how risky these things. These were risky as hell. I mean, one of the problems that got these creatives into trouble was they were selling them as an inappropriate investment to places that should not have been investing in things like this. Because can you see how risky it is? I mean, you just you put in $600 and you're just on the you're just along for the ride for 10 years. You don't see any money at all. So they were highly volatile to begin with because interest rates go up and down. These things would just whipsaw all over the place. But essentially, the idea of them was, let's figure out what kind of a yield these would have. And they had very nasty yields. Let's say this is a 7-year one. Here's how you do the calculation for it. Here's how you do the calculation. It's not that hard, but what you'll do is you'll take the future value over the present value, and you'll raise it to the 1 over the number of years. Put that in parentheses when you do it on your calculator. And then you subtract 1. That'll be the yield. It's actually just a twist on the little formula I did before there. It might not look like it, but it is. Now, if you were to do that for this thing, as a matter of fact, let me turn on this. I'm going to do it on the financial calculator. Just it's just an algebra. Don't even try to worry about it on the financial. Just do it as an algebraic thing. But if you were to do that, I would simply do, in parentheses, I would want to do it. Well, you know, I noticed that they don't really have parentheses on this. Isn't that interesting? I wonder if there's a way to put parentheses on this. Oh, is there some reason this sucks? Oh, well, you might have to do it just on a regular calculator, which doesn't hurt. But if you took 1,000 divided by 600, you want to get that number first, so put that in parentheses, and that'll come out to be 1.6666. Don't round it. For God's sake, don't round until you have to on this. Just say y to the x, and in parentheses, open parenthesis, 1 divided by 7, close parenthesis, and then minus 1. And if you do it for this one, see, the problem I'm having with that one is there's no parentheses. I can't trap that exponent. Well, actually, I could, but that'd be kind of a funky way to do it. I do 1,000 divided by 600, raise that to the 1/7th power minus 1. And you will get 0.0757. So in other words, the yield on this thing is 7.57%. 7.57%. These came to have the name junk bond, because they were so risky. Junk bond refers to anything that is not quote-unquote investment grade. And I'm going to talk about that. I'm going to show you how to read bond prices in the next class. But these were considered not investment grade. Here was the problem with these kinds of bonds, is that they were very touchy. They were sensitive to anything. You could belch and these things would swing in price over their life. I mean, investors could, you know, there was active markets, secondary markets for selling them, but they just went up and down really hard. And they were especially touchy on interest rates. Remember, interest rates go up, prices of bonds go down. Well, when interest rates go up, the prices of these ZCBs went to hell. They were just so sensitive to interest rates. So back in the 1990s, the economy was just doing incredibly well. It just wouldn't quit being great. Stock markets were going up. Everything, unemployment was at a level no one thought could be sustainable. 3.5%, 3.3%. You might have heard in your economics class something called natural unemployment rate, which is kind of like 4.8%. This unemployment fell into the mid and low 3% range. Stock markets were skyrocketing. The Treasury was just swimming in money. We were paying off our bills. We stopped running budget deficits. We were starting to pay off our national debt, for God's sake. It was just incredible. Well, this just pissed off the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, because by the end, we were not issuing any treasury bills anymore. The government didn't need money, so it wasn't issuing T-bills. Hence, the Fed could not execute open market operations and control the economy. Well, Alan Greenspan went before Congress, and he said something that to this day is one of the most incredible things that anyone with a finance background has ever said. He said, the market is showing irrational exuberance. It shouldn't be going up. It's going up because it's irrational. Now, irrationality is a nice term for some your friend who comes over in the middle of the night, strung out, tweaked up on meth, and things like that. But putting that into the context of a stock market, that's like saying a shark is eating me. It's irrational. A dinosaur just stomped on me. That's irrational. Markets don't have rationality. That doesn't mean anything. But he was convinced, oh, this has got to come to an end. We're going to have inflation. We got to slow this economy down. This can't be happening. And finally, the Fed started jacking up the discount rate, meeting after meeting. 8 in a row, I think it was, the longest string of continuous jack-ups in the discount rate in Fed history. And, of course, every time that interest rate went up, those ZCBs felt it. And after about 5-6 of those, the zero-coupon bond market just buckled. Those things just dropped to death, dropped into the ground. Hence, the dot-com boom came to an end in a crash. Michael Milken and the other creatives were all sent to prison. They were vilified. Look what they did. They led investors to hopes that didn't happen. Well, no, that was the interest rates being jacked up when we had exposure with these highly interest rate sensitive securities. That was what caused that market to drop into a rabbit hole. But anyway, ZCBs are actually still around to this day. Once in a while, you'll still see one out there. Almost always, they're rated as junk. Now, here's the thing. There are three rating agencies, bond rating agencies. I think the book focuses on two of those. One, Standard & Poor's, the S&P, rates bonds. Second one is Moody's. The third one, and again, I'm pretty sure the book doesn't mention it, but it's very reputable, is Fitch. Fitch. Now, their rating systems are each one somewhat different, but they're all like AAA, AA, A, BBB, or BBB, down to Cs and pluses. Some of them use pluses and minuses, Ds. And the investment quality is considered from the basis of whether or not it has a high rating with these agencies or not. And so if you're looking for high investment grade, you're going to get low coupons. They're very safe. If you want to play a little bit tougher in the market, get a higher coupon, then you go for something that's a little bit more speculative, maybe a triple B or a BBA or something like that. And if you really want to walk on the wild side, you go for the junk. Some of the stuff that might not even pay off. But at the same time, you always have to remember that these rating services have their own issues. Standard & Poor's, the S&P, was burned because right before the crash of 2008, they were rating some of those bonds and those other securities very high, and they were just absolute crap. Standard & Poor's was fined by the U.S. government. So what did Standard & Poor's do in the wake of being fined and punished for having rated things way too high? Instead of reforming, Standard & Poor's lowered the rating on government debt. They have the hubris that if the government is going to spank them, then they're going to go back and drop the rating on government debt. As I've said, that would be the government's going to pay its bills. That was just ridiculous. But Standard & Poor's, by God, it was going to hold its water and say, nope, we don't accept that we did wrong. Now, here's a personal story, back from my days in consulting. And I won't mention which one of the services I went with, but I would take companies public. I was a reorg specialist. And one of the things that you wanted to do, if you wanted a company to be able to issue debt, you wanted the rating services to give the company a good rating. You get in front of it. Okay, I've got a company. We're going to issue $10 million in 20-year paper. And we would like to have you audit, look at our financials, look at the company's operations, and consider giving us a rating. Well, one of them said, yeah, and I was working with them on three different companies at once. And here was how it worked. They said, okay, we've got, and I said, okay, now hit me hard. How much is this going to cost? And I swear to God, the guy on the phone from this one rating agency said, it depends. I said, what do you mean it depends? He said, what kind of rating you want? Wait, what? In other words, the higher the fee I paid, the more receptive they would be to giving my client's bonds a high rating. Well, what are we talking for something that's investment grade? I'm not asking for a AAA, you know, a B. What are we talking? He quoted me $12 million in fees, and I could get that investment grade on it. Now, this was back in the 90s, but I swear to God, I was going to pay. If I had the $12 million, I could have bought investment grade for my bonds. If I didn't buy it, the coupon on those bonds was going to be nasty. I mean, I'm talking coupons 14, 16%. If I had that rating from that agency on a 2B, I would have probably been able to sell that paper, those bonds, at a rate of maybe 8%, 9%. That was how nasty the world is. And that taste is still in my mouth. When I see those ratings, I still ask myself, how much are they paying to keep those ratings high? I'll put this on a podcast, and they can. I didn't name the rating agency, but I will in private if you want me to tell you which one of those three I told you it was. Mm. Anyway, enough of that nonsense. Look. Here's the thing with a bond. There's one other thing, qualitative. Now, when I'm not doing a whole lot of numbers, just to give you a caution, when I'm not doing a whole lot of numbers, that means that I'm taking you more out of the textbook, I'm taking you more into what I would ask you on a midterm. And so when I talk to you about things like this, this is more midterm bait, which I want you to know, because computers can do the calculations, but the thinking part, that's a little different. Okay, think about this, okay? Now, companies can issue debt instruments of different maturities. For example, a company might have some very short-term stuff out there. As a matter of fact, there's a standardized debt instrument that's like 30 days of money. It's called commercial paper. Commercial paper is 30-day loans, uncollateralized, acquired by very large creditworthy companies. So a very big company could issue, let's say, 50 mil in commercial paper. In other words, they just want to borrow $50 million for 30 days, and then they'll pay it back. It's a very thick market, and it's very safe for the most part. The reason for this one, I'll tell you the reason for this one. Sometimes companies will have a very large amount of cash coming in, but it's not going to come in for a couple of weeks. But they have some expenditure that they're going to have to make like tomorrow or in a few days or a week. And so what they do is, this is like the filler, this cash, it's part of cash flow management, cash budgeting, as it were. And there are courses I can teach you. As a matter of fact, I'll bring it up in this course a little later on. Managing cash, because there's sometimes when you've got a whole lot of money and you're going to have it for a few weeks, and there are times when you don't have a whole lot of money and you need it for a few weeks. And so there's this balancing act that's going on all the time. I had this company, the treasury officer of this one company, large company, was telling me, he said, well, we got this check in for $4 million. Now, we got to get pay a bill. We got a couple of bills outstanding, running about 2.5 mil. And then we got some money that we're going to have to spend in about 2 months. And he said, I sent this check down to our accounts people to process it, to take the receivable off. They got this $4 million check. And they were going to pay the bill that they owe for $2.5 million. And I just hit the roof. The guy said, I just had a fit. Why are you paying it now? Well, because we owe it. No, you owe it in 2 weeks. We've got $2.5 million for 2 weeks. We can invest it. And that's what, you know, that concept of this constant tight control over your money to make a little money off money until you have to pay it out. But anyway, commercial paper is 30-day. It's like an IOU, company issues. Very safe. The commercial paper market has been rattled every once in a while by a bad deal. Enron, in its last weeks, was issuing commercial paper before anyone knew that the company was going to hell. The scammers who were the top officers, they were pumping money into their own personal private accounts in the islands, and they were issuing commercial paper. You know, no one knew that the Enron was on its deathbed. So, yeah, investors were buying this commercial paper up, and they never got their money back. And that kind of hurt the market for a while. Commercial paper is just like, it's as good as gold. And then this scam company screws a bunch of commercial paper buyers. That happens. Okay, now, the decision on how long you want to borrow money for. Is it going to be for a quickie thing and you're going to have money back, you just want to get rid of the debt? That's paper. That's commercial paper or some other kind of a bill. If it's a little bit longer, sort of like a phase of a project, before the project starts to pour money in, you might go a little longer into the notes territory. But if it's really long-term, a capital project, that's where the 30-year stuff comes in. But there are now some that are longer than 30 years. Let's start this. Tell me this. Why would you, as an investor, buy a 30-year bond? You're the original buyer of it. You're going to hold it and then just collect the payments for 30 years and then get your maturity, the $1,000 back. Why would you do that as an investor? Why would you invest in an instrument like that? What kind of an investor would you be that would do that?
Safe reserve one, first and foremost. Maybe like a blue chip company or someone that'll...
Possibly, could be Wabbit. There's a better example. You need a trickle of cash over 30 years, and then you'll take that original money back in reinvestment. What kind of investor, an institutional investor, would want a steady boom, 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 boom amount of cash? What kind of an investor? Got any idea? Any? Got any kind of? How about an insurance company? If you insure enough people, your cash payouts are almost dead certain. It's going to be this month, because as you insure more people, their individual quirks smooth out. So you have a certainty of payout. So wouldn't it be nice to have a certainty of inflow? That would be an insurance company would do that. But what in the world would possess an institutional investor to invest in, let's say, a 100-year bond? What investor would possibly want to invest in a 200-year bond? Any idea? Are you going to live 100 years?
No.
Sure you are. Don't lie. You're.
Well, I want to live 100 years.
I know, right? You know, by the time you get to my age, it gets pretty damn tedious. But, yeah, you get about my age, you know, the only way you can even get the cat to look at you is to hang a pork chop around your neck. Okay. 200 years.
A company that needs a bunch of money.
200 years from now?
200 years from now. I'm really not sure.
Yeah, that's exactly right. What kind of a company would need money way, way out in the future and would have very little chance of needing that money sooner? Fair? I didn't hear.
Oil.
Well, that's an interesting prospect. They're going that, as a matter of fact, I'm glad you brought that up because there was this Arab oil minister. He was explaining that he said, "You people hate us when the price of gasoline goes skyrocketing, oil." He said, "Look, we are going to be out of this oil by the middle of the 21st century. We're gone. It's over. So we need to have as much money now as we can invested in long, long-term things so that we can live comfortably in the time after our oil is gone." That's a good point. Those kinds of countries that are trying to see beyond the great cash flow, the boom days they're having now. That's a very good point. Another one that is very, very common is property and casualty insurers, large commercial. You see, because there are some things that have a very low frequency of occurring, but a staggering severity when they occur. Now, have you ever been in an earthquake? I have. It's rather disturbing. You know, shit's falling down on you, and you're wondering why, complaining about building maintenance, and then you hear people yelling and screaming, and that's bad stuff. They happen. There was one here, right in our part of the country. There's a fault line called the New Madrid. The last time that it broke hard was in the early 1800s. I read a long book that chronicled many of the pages were letters written by the people who lived in the cities out here then. They were writing almost, it was literally like science fiction, apocalyptic science fiction. The smoldering and the staggering and the stench of the bodies. And then the more of these quakes came, one after the other. And then they'd get quiet. Just when they were trying to put things back together, another one would hit. Over a period, I think it was 6 weeks in the early 1800s, the worst of them was so violent that the Mississippi River ran backwards. Now, what really happened was that the heave of the earthquake threw the water of the Mississippi clear north, and then it came back south in a flood, and it wiped out everything in its path when it came back down like a giant tsunami down the Mississippi. That is a once in 200-year, 400-year occurrence. We're due for another one, by the way. That should comfort you, because now we got not just the cities, but we got all these oil pipelines and gas pipelines that crisscross. Basically, we're talking about a barbecue. Uh-huh. On the bright side, if it hits Chicago, I won't have to hear people say, "Go Cubs" anymore. I shouldn't do that. But you see, for an insurance company that insures those kinds of hazards, they don't want their money back next year, 10 years, 30 years, 50 years. They would want their money back in a very long-term kind of framework. Also, think about a life insurance company. Do you remember that I told you that you're going to die someday? Okay, you are. But it's not going to be for... it is for you, but that's... just because of that lifestyle of yours. No, but you're not. They don't need a money to pay off your life insurance for years and years and years, 50 years. So they are going to be the more a clientele that would be interested in those kinds of long-term debt instruments, where they don't really want the money back real soon because they're insuring long-term exposures. So keep in mind that companies issue for their own capital needs, but also the investment bankers keep sort of tweaking to say, well, we've got a lot of clients who are wanting this kind of maturity, this term on their debts right now. So they will tend to kind of help along. Well, we definitely could do these with 20-year. We got a lot of demand for 20-year stuff right now. So there's that dynamic that goes on in the decision-making for how long, what the maturity of a debt series of a bond is. And then there's sometimes companies, they will issue kind of like complex, that they'll have an issue. But I've brought this term up before, and I don't think I've ever formally introduced it. The difference between a primary market and a secondary market. And I now usually this is brought up with stocks, but it's in everything, any security. The primary market is the market where the originating company is selling to the original purchasers, whether it's stocks or bonds. That's the primary market. You will probably personally never be involved, I should hope you won't, in a primary market transaction. Okay, that's the original. Now, the secondary market is the market where investors just buy and sell stuff back and forth. It doesn't directly involve the company, but it does have impact on the company. Sometimes, interestingly enough, companies will enter the secondary market to buy back their own securities. Sometimes they will. You know, stock buyback. There are a couple other things that can go on that, too. But it's the secondary market, it was really odd. It was back in the 90s, in the later 90s, I was doing consulting, setting up companies, mostly doing M&A kind of work, reorgs, getting companies to go public. And there was this little company out of Toronto, I think it was, and they were trading on the NASDAQ, or they had been long, long ago, and they'd been delisted. And they hired me to get them listed again. There was a whole new management team, these hot shots. I didn't really know much about them, but they were paying me to get a 15C211 filed with the NASD to get a trading symbol. Well, it was back and forth, and it cost them more than they expected because they had to have audited financial statements and the whole nine yards. And I finally got the trading symbol authorized, NASD qualified, and I got the trading symbol. And I was really just thrilled by it. And I sent them a fax that morning. Here's your trading symbol. That afternoon, the president of the company called me and said, well, where's the money? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, how do we get the money into our bank account? I said, I don't understand. He said, well, they're buying and selling our stock. When does the money come into our bank account? And I was trying to get my mind around it. He thought that secondary market was money for the company. No, that's just people selling your stock and buying your stock back and forth. That has nothing to do with you. You don't get any of that money. Oh, he threatened to sue me and everything. I thought, well, please do. That will be a riot fest in a court. But he was just convinced that buying and selling, what you see on those ticker symbols, was money the company had something to do with. Nah, it doesn't. It's just investors buying and selling. Now, the company is interested in keeping that stock price up for a couple of reasons. One is the kind of little piss-ass companies that I work with, they wanted that stock price up so the owners could sell stock and get the hell out of there. But in a legitimate company, they want the stock price up because then when they sell more stock, they sell it at a higher price. So they're always concerned about that secondary market price. So they're always putting out good news about the company, always the positive word, and trying to suppress negative comments about the company or negatives about the company. They want that stock price up there in the secondary market because the next time they go to the primary market, they want that stock price to be strong so they can sell original issue at a higher price. Now we come to the interesting thing. Here's the problem with pricing a bond. Let's say I've got TLN, 8%. This is primary. This is original issue. This is original issue. 20, 35. Right there. That's the symbol. That's the trading symbol. That's the trading information. Now, there will be one more piece of trading information, but we're going to do it backwards because the backwards part seems a little bit more logical. Okay, so now, this is the maturity on it. This is the coupon based upon $1,000. So, in other words, every buyer of one of these bonds will get 8% of $1,000 every year for 20 years because this bond will mature in 20 years. However, there's one little step in here you've got to remember. Bonds actually don't pay the 8% every year. They pay half of it every 6 months. So there's a half-year compounding going on in there. So a buyer of one of these bonds would get 8% of $1,000 per year. That'd be $80. But what they'd actually get is two $40 payments every 6 months. Get a $40 payment every 6 months, I should say. You got to remember that. It's just kind of a pain in the butt to do that. But, excuse me. The thing, though, is that, so in other words, here at year one, well, what it would be is 40 and 40. Year two, halfway through 40 and then 40, et cetera, out to year 19, you get a 40 and then a 40 on year 20, and then you get $1,000. You get your face back. Get your face back. Suppose we wanted to know the price that this bond should sell at now. In order to know that, we have to know what the market is discounting this bond's cash flow at. If it's discounting it at 8%, this bond should be flat selling at par. Because in other words, the market says you should pay us 8%, you are paying us 8%. But if the market says you should be paying us 9%, but you're paying us only 8%, then the market's going to punish this bond by dropping its price to sell below par, at a discount to par. If, however, suppose the market said you should pay us 7%, you're paying us 8%, well, that's great. That would cause investors to flow toward this bond and would push the price to a premium to par. So what we need to know is what the market is assessing the discount rate for these cash flows at. Let's say that right now, there's a special term for this. It's called the yield to maturity, the YTM. It's just a discount rate. Remember I told you there are all these different names for the same thing, the discount rate. Suppose that the discount rate right now for these cash flows is 7.6%. In this case, then, would you expect this bond to sell at a premium to par or a discount to par? Yes. When we do the calculation, we should see a price come out of our calculator slightly above $1,000. Because the market's saying, you need to pay us 7.6% based on the risk in the prevailing interest rate environment. Oh, you're paying us 8%? Well, let's buy, and that'll lift the price of the bond upward. So the problem, though, is that I could do the present value, present value, present value, present value, clear out all this way. That is a pain in the derhi rear for a long instrument. Plus, you've got to remember the $1,000 kicker here on the end. Well, thank God for calculators. Looky here. On the financial calculator, how many periods will this bond be paying? What's that? 40. 40, because it's 20 years. There'll be two a year, so it'll be 40. That'll be N. Now, here's where you have to watch it. Don't forget that the discount rate the market is giving, and this I over Y, that's the market. Write that down somewhere. I over Y is the market, not the bond. I over Y is the market. But you got to remember that it's 7.6 divided up two times. Don't forget that. Okay? I swear, even I forget to do that. And then I'm like, well, that's certainly a weird price on that bond. Wait a minute. What the hell? Let's try that again. Really? 7.6? Is there some reason I suck at this? 7.6 divided by 2 equals, really? There, I over Y sort of blew my flow on that. Now, the PV, that's your price we want. What's the price value? Now, the payment is going to be that $40. 80 divided by 2. Here's the thing, though, with this one, there's a face value. The bond has a kicker. Remember I told you about that kicker before? This is where you do it. Unless there's some other reason to do it, put in $1,000. Really? What? You know what? Let's try this again. I'm talking and I'm walking and chewing gum at the same time. 40 is the payment. And then 1,000, put that in as the face value. FV, future value, face value, same word, same letters. Now, compute the price. What's that number? Give me the whole thing. Well, look at that. A premium to par. Not a big one, but a premium to par. The nice thing about these is if you key them in wrong, it'll just look completely ridiculous, your answer. It's almost impossible to get a close answer that you keyed in really way wrong. Well, I'll be darned. By the way, and I mentioned this before, that's the price. Most newspapers, and if you're talking with your broker, they will give you the quote, which is a tenth of the price. And that just goes back historically. It doesn't have a dollar sign. It's a quote. Don't ever put a dollar sign on that thing. But it was just back from the days when the newspapers would print hundreds and hundreds of bonds in these tight columns. They would do it as a tenth of the actual price. It's just historical, and it's still done. I think I told you about that. A friend of mine years ago, he bought these bonds, and he didn't understand that that was a quote. That wasn't the price. He bought 10 of them, and he almost had a heart attack when the broker told him how much it cost. Frank, for God's sake, you didn't buy those at 99. You bought those at 990. Well, why did they say that? Because they did. You were just too stupid, you dumbass. He was an optometrist who thought he was a day trader. Wasn't that great at optometry either. He went blind before he died, but that was because he was a drunk all the time. But anyway, really though. I mean, bond prices are easy to calculate. It's great to show at a party. You know, you'll get a lot of cred. You know, people want to do selfies on Instagram with you. Huh? Yeah, I know, it is. It truly is, you know. It's almost as good as having one of those Hewlett-Packard financial calculators. Not quite as good, but it's cred. Here's the reality. I mean, this is just like an academic exercise. The way it actually works in the real world, we see the price. We see the price. What we don't see is what the market thinks the yield is. So here's the opposite of that. Here it would be in the real world. You'd be watching the ticker. Oh, TLN 8% 2035. I got some of that. Right now, it's quoting at 98.75. That's what you would actually see. And then the question would be, well, what's the yield to maturity based on that? If you look at it, do you see that I know right away that the yield to maturity is above 8%? Do you see that? This thing is selling at a discount to par. In other words, the market doesn't like this thing. It doesn't like that coupon. So it's selling at slightly below par, $100 or $1,000 or $100 on the quote. But this is no problem for us. Look, all you do for one like this is, so let's just clear out all, whoops, I didn't mean to do that. Clear everything out here. Reset. This time, we got 40 payments. We don't know the I over Y. But we do know the price. The price is $987.50. Make sure you put in the right number. And always put in a present value as a positive, as a negative. We'll put that in as a price. We don't forget to put in the kicker. And then compute the yield. for God's sake, don't forget that's a half year yield. You got to times it by two to get a whole year of yield. So if I look at that, what does that yield? 3.145. So times two. I guess you can't do it that way. 3.145 times two. My ass. What did I do wrong there? 0.03145, yeah, but times 2 would be 6.29%.
That's
right. Did I do that right?
Yeah.
I did everything right. It's selling at a discount to par, so the yield to maturity on this sucker is only 6.29%. How in hell? 40? Oh, I forgot to put in the payments, for God's sake. Thank you. There. There's your payments. Now let's compute the yield to maturity. Gee whiz. Okay, 4.06. So in other words, 8.12. The YTM on this is 8.12%. Look at that. The yield is above the coupon. In other words, the market's saying you should be paying us 8.12. You're paying us only 8%. We're going to punish this bond's price. We're going to sell it and drop the price. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.